Evening, Bob. This is the second of our enemy sessions. Great to have you here this evening. It's in New Zealand. It's Tuesday, the 29th of April, 2011, which makes it the 28th Monday in Hawaii. And we're continuing with looking at Andrew McLuhan's blog, Inscriptorium.
Yeah, so we are still in December. The last entry for December 2010 dated December 31st, and he says, "Today I'm on the pound shell."
So the title was MCL/ Get On With The Job.
Right, that's Ezra Pound's, you know, short staccato, what do you call those people? Shorthand way of talking to McLuhan, which we've seen in some of the letters.
Yeah, he was just published. He was text messaging. Ezra Pound was the first text messenger.
That's right. Now, you see hyper-tech messaging in Finnegan's Wake, though.
No. Joyce uses way too many letters. Like, in a sense, yes, but Joyce is like a French verbal version of what Pound does with absolute efficiency and economy.
No. You take the word "get" here. What Joyce is doing, he has the letter G, texts the letter I, and the letter I responds with the letter T. It goes on in the little syllables in Finnegan's Wake.
That's subatomic texting. I don't think that we've got to that level yet.
Yeah, well, Joyce has done it and is waiting for us to catch up. Pound is still referring to logocentric stuff, even though it's stuttered.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so what's that intrasyllabic dialogue within the text message itself? Yeah.
Okay, so, but that is for this purpose. Yeah, early first tech messaging. So he goes, "Today I'm on the pound shelves," which should be exciting, I'm thinking. This will be fun. "I'm working on cataloging the books mixed with Eric's on his own shelves before tackling the many still in old boxes. Some have not seen the light of day since after Marshall's death, when they were packed up from his office in the Center for Culture and Technology, University of Toronto, or from his home office. Speaking of Marshall's death, it happened 30 years ago today, New Year's Eve. Requiescat in peace." You know what that means? Rest in peace, I guess?
I guess so. Speaking of dates, I noticed that the birthday has been changed in the first post that we looked at.
We should go back and look at his responses to our post. So I'm going to go back to first things.
Yeah, first things, it's been changed to July 21. So good on you, Andrew. Nice work.
Yeah, and so at the bottom, I said on March 24th, Andrew Kristol and I taped some remarks about your blog. Each part is about 50 minutes long. So there's three parts listed. And his response is, "Thanks for your interest, I think." Then he says, "There are some errors, and I'll correct them as I become aware of them. Numbers, especially, are not my strong point." So we'll see if he corrected the death date of Marshall, which is maybe the next one. After first things, let's see. Checking. You remember there was a mistake there?
Yeah, where he had it listed as January 30 instead of December 31.
Right, so... do I make a comment? Okay, so we know he did that somewhere. And did you see if he corrected it?
No, I haven't checked that. Oh, no, okay. I do. He has corrected it.
Okay, so here he's saying New Year's Eve. He's got the right date. And he says, "So requiescat in peace sounds like rest in peace? Must be. Right? What do you think? Do you know your Latin?"
No, it's my great flaw, among others.
Okay. All right. Ezra Pound typed in a letter to Marshall McLuhan that I found tucked between the pages of a book on Pound, a book by Harold Watts called Ezra Pound and the Cantos, mailed from Washington in 1953. So this is the period 53. You've seen the letters where Pound is getting a little irritated with McLuhan and saying, "It doesn't matter where anybody got something from, is what he does with it. Get on with it, boy." So the getting on with it in the title here is kind of said in other letters of that period. You recall that?
Yeah, well, it's where Pound tells him to be concerned with credits, not debts. But yes. It's definitely towards the end of where they're dialoguing with each other.
Yes, and McLuhan lays out the Gutenberg Galaxy plan to him in 53, and there's no response from Pound. It's almost like McLuhan was testing Pound. Pound didn't get it, so McLuhan knew he had broken into the silent sea, that leaving Pound behind. So I see him leaving Pound in 53 and starting his own scene with explorations.
Yeah, well, one of the last letters, I mean, the dialogue with Pound tapers off, I think, substantially in 1952. So if this is 53, it's actually right at the very end of that correspondence.
Yeah, there might have been correspondence after that, but there's not too much offered in the book of letters that came out in 1987. Okay, so he says, McLuhan, the laborers in Dillard's garden are few. / Ergo, McLuhan ought not to sink into desuetude and leave all the wake to his star pupil. Star pupil be Don Thiel, maybe?
Kenner.
Oh, yeah, Kenner, right. Yeah, and Kenner's book has just come out around then. So he's saying, McLuhan ought not to sink in and dissuade you to leave all the wake. So, but we know McLuhan. See, that's the thing. He doesn't know McLuhan's moving into larger landscapes than doing literary criticism. Leave that for Kenner to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Pound's interesting. And I've talked to Scott Eastham about this quite a lot. I mean, Scott's line is that Pound was... I'm going to do this in real abridged form. Was extolling McLuhan to follow the money, go and do the economics, because that's where he was at that point. And oddly, as you've pointed out in your cash flow sessions really well, in the final decade, in fact, the last half of the... final decade of his life, McLuhan does end up offering an economic understanding, or a loosely economic understanding.
Yeah, I was talking about today on the McLuhan and Mom number 5. We bring up, we had Riff Ryder, who works right in the heart of the Wall Street digital world. He knows a lot about it. He came up with this phrase, the flash crash of May 5th or 6th, 2010. And so I got him to be the instant guest Jen Savant to like her a bit about the environment he's in. But I turned him on to the immediate approach to inflation from September 21st, 1974, the op-ed by McLuhan. And we discussed that, and that is what you're referring to. He really was the genius of what was coming, you know, last 10, 15 years. He had it nailed in 74. People can see how the word makes a market today, but McLuhan first said that, as far as I know, in 1974. He may have said it in Take Today, but Take Today is the ground for that book. And so you're saying that he got into the finance stuff in the 70s, yes. Let's see.
The interpretation, like, I guess the surface interpretation is that McLuhan went into, like, he shifted into media environments, and then at the end he turned to economics. But I guess there's another reading as well, which is Pound, I think, was a real big deal for McLuhan, and there is a possibility that he did follow the money, and that media studies was following the money. And that's another way of interpreting that footnote to Innes. Innes is a economist, and so I think, you know, there is a possibility that you could read McLuhan as being an economist actually the whole way through, which would be an interesting take.
No, that's what I've said to Harold Channer for years. And, you know, he thinks he's an economist, is interested in economists like the guy Kelso, Louis Kelso, Bucky Fuller. He never, when I started telling him when we first met, you know, in 2000, that McLuhan was the best economist of them all, he thought it was nuts. And he still didn't get it, even when I got him to read The Immediate Approach to Inflation. He can't see it. But you're the first person to agree with me about... He definitely was. He was taking on every department in the university. He was taking on physics, economics, sociology, all of them. That's the point. He was a Leonardo da Vinci. you know, for the software age, taking them all on and say, you guys don't see what I've hit on the key to all this, to your puzzles and quandaries. So definitely now, I don't, he did not go into economics in the 70s. He just, it was time to get the, that book done. So he did the book, and it was the right time because the implosion of electric media, of the analog phase, before you flip into the digital fragmentation, led to the idea of conspiracy happening through Watergate. And McLuhan, there was a radio TV interview he did around that time. He said, we're moving into information hunting and man hunting, because that's the period when man was becoming figure and ground. And so therefore you would start to think there were conspiracies, or one man could do a whole big thing in Watergate, could run a conspiracy. That's when people started investigating the Rockefellers. They had done it before the John Birchers, but it became widespread. And Watergate was the figure that we moved into, who is the man ground, since figure and ground have merged. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's why he said Kissinger was the guy. He was the trigger man and the kiss of death. But the phrase trigger man is used back in the letter to Pound in 52, June 22nd, 1951. The conspiracy part, the top-down bureaucratic control, McLuhan was raising a question for Pound and all those guys that view is not appropriate. And when around the time that Understanding Media came out in 64, I have an obscure interview in a newspaper where he's talking about Lyndon Johnson becoming the new president. And he says it's a ground thing where the South is more resonant to the electric mood of TV. So you're going to have a Southern president like LBJ, and he beats Barry Goldwater. And he says it wasn't a conspiracy. He makes a point to say it wasn't a conspiracy. So he has the right-wing quadrant of his own network of friends in mind, and he's critiquing them. And he's always doing that, and he's emphasizing the bottom-up effects of media, how it makes the John Birchers view anemic. But it doesn't mean that he also noticed that the implosion of figure ground, of man becoming figure ground, would lead to someone running the show in the late 60s, early 70s, and that's when he started talking about the Antichrist. But it was not a knee-jerk, you know, conspiracy theory. So he did not move towards the economic emphasis in the 70s. It's just that it surfaced as a figure that he could have talked about a long time before, but it was only, the ground had shifted to respond to that conspiracy view. And so he provided a book for that. He actually anticipated Watergate. But again, he didn't stay with that too long. In private conversations, you hear about it, you know, the secret societies and that, but he always pointed out they don't have any ground anymore. So that's what, and that is what he realized with Pound. Was it Hugh Kenner in his obituary of McLuhan for William Buckley's book, magazine, National Review? He says McLuhan is the only guy he knew in the early 50s who got into conspiracy stuff and lived to tell the tale and broke through from it. That's the meaning of his breakthrough and leaving Pound in 53 to do explorations. So, okay, that's what I'm saying. Back to what you're saying. You're saying you noticed him moving into this economic emphasis in the 70s. No, he always was an economist.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. That's an alternate reading, is like that you wouldn't pick up possibly unless you saw this, the undercurrents of what Pound was prodding McLuhan to do.
Yeah, McLuhan knew that. I guess you could, I mean, Pound knew that information was running the show, but he saw money as the key information medium. So he got hoodwinked by the, Othello's Glove, which is actually the Thompson quadrant, my chart, and I have Pound in the LaRouche quadrant. But the it was a Trump Leal. Pound missed the, and you know, in Kenner's book on Bucky Fuller, on Pound, he talks. Have you read The Pound Era?
Yeah.
There's a beautiful section near the end where Pound finally meets Bucky Fuller, because he attends one of those cultural conferences in Italy in 1970, and Bucky is rising, is replacing McLuhan as a figure on the hip scene or the avant-garde scene. So Pound leaves his Venice bunker and goes up there to see him, and they get together. And Kenner, who was talking to both of them at the time, doing books on both of them, said that the cassettes of Bucky's speech, Pound got, took him back and listened to him over and over again. And May and Kenner, knowing a bit slightly of McLuhan's level of understanding, knowing the limitation of the conspiracy view, he says Pound probably sat there listening to Bucky Fuller's new vision and recognized the mistake he himself had made in going off, you know, on the Don Quixote thing of trying to find out who was controlling the printing press. That's a very, do you remember that part of the Pound era?
No, that doesn't. I struggled with that book. I was under time pressures, and I found it very long and drawn out for something that I thought didn't actually deserve that much attention.
Okay, well, get the book and look at the end part of the Bucky Fuller Pound correspondence. And Kenner very perceptively points out he either was talking to Pound, was around him, noticed the vibe, visited him. He said that Pound was like forever re-listening to these tapes and saying, this Fuller guy's got something that I didn't realize. You know what I mean? And it was also because Pound was isolated in the Italian rural scene and was missing the digital or the computer world and what was happening to finance. So it's a very touching scene, and Pound dies shortly after that. What am I saying here? Why are we bringing this up? Pound?
Oh, the laborers in the Laird's garden are few, ergo MCL ought not to sink into destitute and leave all the weak to his star pupil.
Yeah, see, he's still a POB, Pound, you know, for all his bringing in acoustic space and those other sensory dimensions to his poetry. In the end, he still can't drop the writing world. McLuhan can drop that.
Yep, the letter, two typed pages, is complex. Not sure what most of it means, but the tone is almost confrontational. Not surprising, as Pound was apparently a cantankerous fella. I'm sure that's putting it nicely. Reading the following. Okay,
Before you go into it, that confirms what you suspect. I mean, Pound's realizing McLuhan is not under his spell anymore. And so it's the guru yelling at the student as the student leaves. Do you know what I mean? And that's, he's saying that Pound's cantankerous. No, Pound's pissed off that the new guy, the talent he wants on his team, is not, you know, not getting this. And if you go back and look at the letter where he writes about Gutenberg Galaxy and what he's doing in 53 to Pound, that's a telling letter. You had it right there. I don't know if the editors give us the response of Pound to that, but McLuhan just dumps it on Pound, a whole new level. And I don't think Pound gets it, but he notices, this guy isn't talking my language anymore. So it's not because Pound is a cantankerous, he's pissed. And so let's see if we can see it in the excerpts that Andrew makes. So shall I do it?
Do your best, Pound, Bob.
Okay, they yell fascism, but not one damn word in 10 years regarding corporate state, in which the idea is that people vote on what they understand and that the representatives of the different kinds of understanders, i.e. those who understand different activities, then assemble and work out a just agreement. So that's the democratic idea, which the sewer smears as tyranny, having tricked the small people out of all voice in their real government. And the men who know really some detail are kept from meeting and intercommunication, which obstruct causes time lag, which gives the crooks time to operate unhindered.
I was just struck by that use of intercommunication. That's the first time I've seen Pound using that. And McLuhan made that point, I think, in where he didn't want to use the word communication and really wanted to use this intercommunication word.
Right. And maybe he said it to Pound, and Pound saying it back to him, using it. The aim of law, capital L-A-W, is to prevent coercion either by force or by fraud. The aim of law is to prevent coercion either by force or by fraud. McLuhan, get on with the job. And then end of poem, and then Andrew says, one can see why he eventually had to flee the United States. Okay, so Pound, yeah, went right off to Italy. You know the story, from what I remember, he showed up for one neo-Nazi party walk somewhere in the States or in Italy in 1960 about, and then after that one, you know, going back to the old days and with the triad, he goes into silence shortly after that. So, let's see. So what he's complaining about, see, this is my, the LaRouche quadrant. This is people thinking that the bureaucratic structure of the United States has been usurped by the corporate state or corporate bureaucrats, which who were then hijacked by secret government by committee, which is the Trilateral Commission or any, the Committee of 40 back then. They're missing the information environment that's making sense out of money, making money, creating credit. He does not see it, and he wants McLuhan to, you know, somehow take on the corrupt mafias operating in all levels, which Marshall understood are inevitable in an oral retrieved society. You know, the oral mafias take over the cities, and he writes about that in Take Today. You can actually see in Take Today thoughts McLuhan might have said to Pound back in the early 50s. I don't know if he would, but he's addressing the Pound view all through Take Today, which is why Mark Stallman, you know, when he came to Toronto in 1994, wanted to find where McLuhan wrote about Pound, and no, wrote about power. And Tom, Mark Stallman had the LaRouche Poundian concerns of who had power and who was running the strings behind the scenes. And Eric or Wayne, one of them, or Barry Nevitt, told him, well, that book is the Take Today. So I don't know if he, I don't think he understood when he read Take Today until he met me when I laid it out a bit more appropriately. But he was looking, he was the Poundian sensibility, Mark Stallman, looking to see if Marshall had done anything. Yeah, Marshall had addressed that. And what else would you say? Anything else?
Pound essentially, when he was on radio for the for Mussolini, wasn't he essentially spouting off American Founding Fathers stuff?
Yes, he was. You can read it in Cantos, John. It's exactly the same stuff LaRouche does. They go back and find out, you know, it's the battle between the Jeffersonian country bumpkins against the Hamiltonian city slickers, and whether you should have a federal, a central bank or not. And people think that McLuhan is a Jeffersonian in the 40s, and he may have been, but he certainly got more sophisticated in his understanding of the factors once he read Innes. So Innes is in this battle. Innes is a guy pointing out the bottom up, questioning what the left might say, or those that critique the corporate state. So here is Pound calling the corporate state a bureaucracy and linking it to industrial government structures and making a big issue out of democracy and missing the democratic effect of television, that the information environment becomes free and everybody can enjoy the same multi-billion service environments regardless of who claims to be controlling the finances behind it. He's mistaking the new software corporate effect, the software communism, as a bureaucratic structure with a secret government where it's the actual super audience working for itself. And software communism is what Marshall means by corporate. You drop the state. The corporate world is software communism, but Pound puts in the state. And if you see in my chart, I've got the state as the certain category in the LaRouche Pound quadrant. That's five categories from this book. I can't remember exactly what it is right now, but I was using a structure that was set out by a book written, funded by some Rockefeller Foundation or something. It laid out the media environment, the state environment, the third world environment, I'd have to get my chart up to remember. But anyways, corporate state. Yeah, state is the second world. Remember Marshall's four worlds? First world is advanced industrial corporate life. No, advanced industrial development. And the second world is Russian bureaucracy. And then the third world is the underdeveloped world, and the fourth world is the electric world that goes around all the first three.
Yep.
You see, they're still seeing, you know, Pound is still a 19th century guy, you know, running for local government, trying to get rid of those international capitalists or something, or international communists or whatever. So this is a good statement of the ideal of the LaRouchian quadrant, that the people who went, if you're educated and literate and understand who's running what, then you're qualified to help the people get informed. But they didn't know that we're Pound and Luce didn't know we're moving into a post-information phatic society, which people understood.
I just had a look at what McLuhan was writing in 53, and we've got his review of Paul Klee in Shenandoah, and he says, in Finnegan's wake, Joyce took up all the new media and fused them with the words and gestures of the mind. His verbi-voco-visual technique presents us with an orchestration of all current and traditional media as an all-night newsery reel of both the collective existence of the race. And so, yeah, you can see, I guess, his awareness has transited way out of the Pound quadrant, as it were.
Yeah, now here I can fill that in. Now, I don't know that review. Where you got that in Ottawa?
Yeah, it's published in Shenandoah in spring 1953.
Yeah, I don't know if I have that in my archives. I went, it may not be listed in the bibliography. Oh, okay. Anyways, he writes to Pound on June 22nd, 51, words are today a drug. They were a bit of a ground back. He says, back in your day, you know, you changed the language and helped they update sensibility. But now words are drugs, and that's the problem I'm working on. What you've just said there, where he says new media fuses with words and gestures, is the issue that he was saying to Pound, but it's better said there or broken apart and given the parts of it are laid out. That's a very good sentence as an explanation of what Marshall meant the problem was when words are drugs. Well, they fuse, words and gestures fuse with the discarnate media. And therefore, they're the content of the electric silence. They're the things that everybody's running around being addicted to and being informed on and learning information about and, you know, listening to people like the Birchers and later LaRouche, all the political guys, left, right, and center, studying the content of the electric silence, which is words, but it's only a drug.
Yep. In the same article, McLuhan's also pointing out that he's not really interested in chasing the money so much. He concludes that it's that the metaphysical and cognitive character of the procedure, which is retracing the stages of apprehension, providing the artistic formula of new experience, should be kept free from sectarian warfare. So he's his problems are of an entirely different stripe.
That's right. Now, I was just going to say something. Oh, yeah, here it is. I brought this up in the Monday night seminar or simulation we did today. This is not known. I don't think you've ever noticed this. In some article in the late 60s, this is in the, you know, his high visibility period where he's writing for mainstream magazines. In one of those, he says, in 67, 68, which at that time, there was beginning to worry that there was a bit of recession coming in. But I don't know if he was right before that. But he said that the market, the world market, will be extremely abundant. There's so much that anything can be wealth now that there's no way that there could be any devastating crash anymore. He said that there would be an expanding wealth in the market, stock market and that, endless wealth. And he actually anticipated the boom from 1982 to 2008, and he actually explained it. And then he adds more to it in the 1974 article. But you've probably never seen that sentence. He was explaining how the wealth was inevitable, that since everything could be content for software communism, anything could be invested in, anything could be sold, anything could be exchanged for anything else, that seamless web of economic activity guaranteed a non-crash, a complete depression. Did you know that sentence? You know what I'm referring to? Sound familiar?
No.
Yeah, and so that's an economic vision he has. He's actually explaining, you don't get it too much in the 70s. You don't have a total depression, but you have stagflation. But the boom from 82 to 2008 is incredible, the stock market boom. And that's what I mean by Orphic Baroque spiral on my chart. He said that will happen. And there's a quote on the economics level. Nobody knows that McLuhan predicted the abundance of the the virtual abundance of 82 to 2008.
No, no, not at all.
Yeah. So do we want, he says, they yell fascism. So he's saying the political nitpickers and nannies making sure everything is kept politically correct are complaining about fascism, but don't notice the corporate state, which, what, I guess an international world government thing, which is what a lot of the early conspiracy theorists were noticing in the 50s and 60s, like Eustace Mullins, who was a student of Ezra Pound, and they went on to investigate the roots of the Federal Reserve and the Rothschild Empire and this and that. They're not seeing the software simulation that's happening around them, and McLuhan is. So do you see where he says, they yell fascism, but not one damn word in 10 years regarding the corporate state, or, quote, the world government, or the, or what, remember what McLuhan said in Goober Galaxy, Big Brother goes inside.
Yeah.
He knew about that, but he knew that they were forced to go inside because they were becoming a subset of the new populist expression, let's call it, in which, and he says, the corporate state, in which the idea is that people vote on what they understand. So I think he's giving an ideal here, right? It's not the definition of corporate state. Regarding corporate state, in which the idea is that people vote on what they understand and that the representatives of different kinds of understanders, i.e. those who understand different activities, then assemble and work out a just agreement. Is he saying that's the ideal, or the corporate state promotes that idea? I don't know if he's complaining about the image of democracy and that there isn't any, but I guess it could be taken either way. And so then he says, which the sewer smears as tyranny. So I think he's saying that the actual democratic ideal is given a bad name. It's smeared. The sewer is the secret, you know, Big Brother behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Smears as tyranny, having tricked the small people out of all voice in their real government. Now, they haven't tricked out of all voice. Pop culture is coming in. You know, Elvis Presley, rock and roll. That upsets the sensibilities of the oligarchs right there. And they go on to kill Kennedy because here's this image swamping everybody and going beyond the sense of real control by Big Brother behind the scenes. So they have to kill the image because they're panicking under the power of the TV image. And Kennedy represent the voice of, quote, the real government, the people. Now, it was just an image, but you see, to talk about the voice in the real government, now, back then, that would be a solid issue. But McLuhan knew and predicted that the simulation was going to take over and that the voice, your voice was not, your voice could not be implemented into legislative bureaucratic structures. Your voice could be implemented into talk radio and into new popular forms of expression, electric expression, like the counterculture or rock and roll and that. You get a point there that is very rear-view mirror.
Yeah, so yeah. I think that's where that Paul Klee article comes in, is because McLuhan's essentially talking about the possibility of locking down the simulation, like in its goodness. Yeah, and whereas Pound sort of go, he's groping at some after image of something which is no longer possible.
Of what the postmoderns call a public space. He still thinks there's a public space that you can have it used as a fulcrum. Okay, so the if Pound is concerned about updating the voice, and McLuhan knows the voice is a drug, see, there's the difference. He thinks there is a voice that's an authentic voice that the people could use to throw out the liars behind the scenes. And they are liars from McLuhan's point of view because they will not admit, the oligarchs will not admit that the medium is the message. They like people to think that the oligarchies run the show behind the scenes, like Pound thought, so that the oligarch doesn't have to admit the real truth, the real X-ray, the real transparency that McLuhan was pointing out. So here's Pound looking for an authentic voice, and McLuhan sees that all voices are drugs and merge with the discarnate new media silence.
Yeah, well, words and gestures.
Yes, words and gestures. And Joyce is gestures. Words is Pound, and Joyce, you know, is couldn't see him as developing the idea of Jester from the priest Jousse, J-O-U-S-S-E. But, of course, Joyce saw the movie image and the TV image as an expansion of the Jester. So anyways, yeah, voice and Jester. And McLuhan likes to think that that sentence is what Finnegan's Wake was about. Now, it's a McLuhan's version of Finnegan's Wake. It's debatable whether Joyce saw that, but the words of Joyce, what he created, points to what McLuhan saw, whether Joyce knew it or not.
Yeah, that's a nice way of saying it.
Yeah. Oh. And then he says, and the men who know really some detail. No, they need to know the big picture or the scanned picture, the post-visual tactile envelope. So he's describing what McLuhan knows, but he's got it backwards. And so it's, remember how McLuhan said he wished you'd get five scholars, him and Ong, living to be in the same environment, the same campus?
That would be an incredible revolution, yeah.
Right. And Pound wants that, but he wants it for rearview mirror purposes.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point. Like, I think Pound was very much the model for McLuhan's ventures in terms of network and his early gatherings and how to rouse a gang in that respect.
Yeah, but see, he could have joined Pound like he was going to do a magazine with Lewis. He could have joined those guys, but by the late 40s, he sees that you would get together a gang, a clique, and a team, not for the Pound or Lewis purposes.
Yes.
Lewis was the closest to articulating the new landscapes and more than Pound. And Joyce gives the verbal translation of that mixed corporate media situation. But there'd be no reason for McLuhan to create a new newsletter. If he was back in Pound's camp, he'd just support Pound. Pound would be the leader.
Yeah, in that sense, Joyce supplies the content, Lewis is the spirit, and Pound supplies the technique and strategy.
Okay, do that again. Lewis supplies what?
Lewis is like the spirit of the enterprise, of McLuhan's enterprise, in a sense.
Yeah.
Joyce provides the content and diagnosis, as it were,
right.
As in the best way of looking at what we're looking at. And
yeah.
Pound provides the techniques and strategies of assembling the milieu and actually achieving it.
Yeah, and all of them create a fourth level, which is neither of them, and that's McLuhan. McLuhan reaching out not with literary people, but looking for Norbert Wiener and people in all kinds of other fields. Pound, Joyce, and Lewis may have still been involved in the artsy world.
Yeah. I guess we've got that that great letter to Norbert Wiener where he says, where is it? To Innes. Where he's talking about updating the procedures of literature, where I think Wiener and the MIT crowd are of much greater value.
Yeah. And see, Pound wants to politicize the aesthetes, the literary poets and intellectuals, the book people. McLuhan is leaving, he calls it in some letter to Wiener, is it? He says the little clacks and mags are nothing compared to what's going on down
MIT.
MIT, yeah. At MIT. And so, yeah, McLuhan sees the new technical. It's the beginning of virtual technocracy. McLuhan sees that. Pound can't see it.
Yeah, well, here it is in 53. I'm harping on this review of Paul Klee. Page 80, McLuhan notes how in America, language cannot have the same authority as machinery.
Right. Remember, he says in that essay, maybe Space, Time, and Poetry, he talks about the European takes machines and translates it back into verbal media, whereas the American takes verbal landscapes and translates them into machinic or technological landscapes. That's the difference between North American art and European art.
Yep.
And Lewis is more American than European, and Joyce is more European than... If you have Joyce... He's doing the technology translated back into verbal media, verbal landscapes. Lewis is groping to the technological landscape, and not going the the European Joyce direction. But Lewis, being in Britain, is caught in between. So he makes very extravagant verbal books, but he's pointing to the technological landscapes that the European or Joycean doesn't do.
Yeah, well, I think this can be sort of, in the next sentence, this sort of sums it up. And I think, is it Joyce, Yeats, Eliot, and Pound from the periphery of the English culture were freer to filter the new experiences of the century through the traditional medium in a way impossible to those at the center.
That's right. Now notice he leaves out Lewis. See, they're doing the traditional media. Lewis is trying to grapple as a, you know, as a consultant to City Hall,
yep,
saying, you know, I want to help design your cities. He sees the newer landscapes. That's why he's indifferent to the Bloomsbury literary claques, who are aligned in different fragments of them with Joyce and Eliot and that. Not Lewis. He's actually the most McLuhan-esque in that scene of The Vortices. He's interested in talking to other technologists. He doesn't get as far as McLuhan, but you see that's the spirit of Lewis. Now you say the technique is a Pound and the... I don't think you can bring in Joyce and Pound. Maybe Pound is a social organizer, but not Joyce. McLuhan is actually more Lewisian than Joyce in terms of seeing the media en bloc. And that is Don Thiel's objection that... Don favors the European translate the technological back in the verbal, and he loves the verbal play Finnegan's Wake, and says McLuhan misses that and diminishes the Wake by making it into the technological landscapes. Thiel mistakenly calls that reductionism or simplification, but Thiel is fetishizing those book works, those cultural artifacts. McLuhan's not interested in those artifacts per se. That he's interested in showing them as effects of the new landscapes, which is Lewisian. So Thiel calls McLuhan and Eric Marshall and Eric and Lewis Manipians, not what's that guy's name? Forget the other John Dry, the other kind of Manipian.
Veronian.
What? Oh, Veronian, right?
Or you can have Lucianic.
Yeah, which the Veronian is like, you know, Mardi Gras kind of a Manipian, or hanging out and celebrating in European festivals, not the austere, detached, not engaging in the party of the cynical Manipian. Anyways, Thiel makes a division between Manipian and Veronian, and I would say that the description of McLuhan as a cynical Manipian versus the you can't handle the Veronian carnivalesque. And obscene engagement with senses and pornography, that is not what McLuhan is about. McLuhan is on another level, not on the book level or the culture content of Gutenberg-Gaussi level. He's looking at new landscapes and being Veronian in response to it.
Okay, so if I can just possibly...
Now, what I say about Veronian, just as... You look at the article in Newsweek in 1966, I think it's February 66. There's McLuhan having pictures taken of himself with his face puffed up with all clownish facial gestures on purpose. He's clowning. He's not being a cynic. Okay, what were you going to say?
Well, I'm just trying to maybe nail down this distinction that we're making in terms of McLuhan. Well, we've got McLuhan and Pound arguing about who's at the center of culture in the 1950s, in a sense. We've just talked about Don, he stresses Joyce, Erasmus, Rabelais, the quadrivial, the occult, and a sort of a carnivalesque Veronian satire. Eric,
yeah,
by contrast, he stresses Bacon, Vico, Aquinas, the patristics, and the trivium, and a more cynical kind of Manipianism. And here we, you know, I guess what we're trying to draw out is that McLuhan left that verbal world behind. What are we trying to draw attention to?
He's not in those distinctions. Those are Gutenberg-Gaussi distinctions, correct in their own context. Thiel is brilliant on that, but that's... You do not judge McLuhan with those categories. McLuhan is very Veronian with the way he writes letters to executives of huge corporations and is actually teasing them and satirizing them, but willing to work with them. He's not being the enemy all the time. Lewis was, you know, Lewis was cantankerous in that sense, like like Pound, but he just did it on a different level. McLuhan was subtle and, you know, and diplomatic like T.S. Eliot was. Could work with the establishment or the fuddy-duddies. Do you know what I mean? And make fun of them with them when they wouldn't even know it. So McLuhan is doing Joyce's maxim of silence, exile, and cunning in a new way, whereas Pound and Joyce and Lewis are...
The Eliot connection, because Eliot went on to be a real significant figure in English letters, and what he was the head guy at Faber, wasn't he, for a little while?
Yeah, he got. Did you say guided?
Yeah, essentially.
Oh yeah, he was the main editor. He kept the Vortices published, and he goes on. But see, McLuhan achieved the same thing by getting the Order of Canada. Now, this is what's interesting about McLuhan's more complex situation in the 70s. And McLuhan, one quarter of himself, McLuhan being a quadrophenia by necessity, because the environment was quadrophenia, one quarter of himself gets the Eliot level of respectability, gets the Order of Canada, but another quarter of himself is a Lewis guy down in the coach house taking pot shots at everybody. See, back in before World War II, Eliot couldn't have been that complex. You getting what I'm saying here?
Yeah, totally.
McLuhan actually does, as I have in my chart, he does Joyce, he does Lewis, he does Eliot, he does Yeats, and he does Pound as fragments. And then he even says the different media dynamics, the different characteristics of the different media, laid out in Understanding Media. You've got the Joyce medium, the Pound medium, and the Eliot medium, and the Lewis medium, which is where I have it on my chart. Newspaper is Pound. Electric content, rock and roll is McLuhan, and the printed book is the Thompson Quadrant, which is Eliot. And I have electric media content as McLuhan and Lewis. And then the movie is Yeats and the Croker Quadrant. And then Joyce is the magazine. In the Dobbs Quadrant, you have magazine, which covers all the fields. Now, that's what Joyce does. I mean, I understand Finnegan's Wake is a magazine, but McLuhan is not looking at a limited visual magazine. He's looking at the news shows like 60 Minutes kind of magazines. All right? Multimedia magazines. So, anyways, where do we go with that? No, it's good to bring in, if you're noticing the point that there was an Eliotic streak in McLuhan that he accomplished. See, this is amazing. He was a pillar in his church, I imagine. I never went to McLuhan's church, but, you know, he went to Mass and the Trinity Church, I think it is, on St. Clair Avenue. I'm sure he had some kind of local community responsibility. When you talk to Mark Stewart, he did all kinds of things like helping Salvation Army, unknown to people. Lewis couldn't do that. He had no money.